The Oscar-winning director of The English Patient has died of a brain hemorrhage. 54-year-old Anthony Minghella had completed just 8 films, but they had been nominated for 24 Academy Awards. Bob Mondello has an appreciation.
Anthony Minghella made his first film, Truly, Madly, Deeply, in 1990. As a cinematic outsider, he was an acclaimed British playwright, moonlighting in a field he'd never so much as dipped a toe in. So perhaps it makes sense that the material that most attracted him was about outsiders. Complicated tales, often adapted from novels, about characters who play roles to please or be close to or deceive those they care about. Truly, Madly, Deeply's dead man who returns from the afterlife to comfort the woman he loves. Cold Mountain's wounded Confederate soldier who struggles to get home to a woman he's barely met. And the film Minghella's best known for, The English Patient, about a World War II casualty whose identity is unclear, seemingly even to himself.
I think I was a pilot. I was found in the wreckage of a plane at the beginning of the war.
Can you remember where you were born?
Am I being interrogated? You should be trying to trick me, make me speak German, which I can, by the way.
Why? Are you German?
No.
How do you know you're not German, if you don't remember anything?
Might I have a sip of water?
The English Patient, which told this man's story in achingly romantic flashbacks, won 9 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, and vaulted Minghella, after just 3 movies, into the ranks of Hollywood's most sought-after directors. The film he followed up with continued his fascination with mystery and role-playing, The Talented Mr. Ripley, about a man who pretends to be someone he's not so that he can get close to the man he wishes he could be.
Don't you just take the past and put it in a room in the basement and lock the door and never go in there? That's what I do.
God, yes. Of course, in my case, it's probably a whole building.
And then you meet someone special, and all you want to do is toss them the key. But you can't. Because it's dark, and there are demons. And if anybody saw how ugly it is,
the music talking.
Minghella liked to let the music talk when he was directing. Though he wrote nearly all of his screenplays, his film's most evocative passages are often wordless. Think of The English Patient with its longing gazes and rippling sand dunes, framed only by swells in the score. Minghella directed opera at the Met, wrote musical arrangements for Appalachian folk songs he used in Cold Mountain, and in The Talented Mr. Ripley, he found a musical way to show that while everything about Ripley was false, it was a persuasive copy of what he admired. He did it by placing the character in a situation where he couldn't avoid singing, and then having him improvise a jazz riff in uncanny imitation of Chet Baker.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart.
Anthony Minghella's career has now been cut short before its music could play out, but he had completed another novel adaptation, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, which will be shown on British television this week. He had 2 more projects lined up to follow, and he had also become a major film producer, with such pictures as Michael Clayton to his credit. An outsider no more in an industry he graced for barely 18 years. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
His voice was compared to the sound of a Rolls-Royce starting up. His acting was likened to that of John Gielgud and Richard Burton. Englishman Paul Scofield was best known in this country for his Oscar-winning role in A Man for All Seasons. Scofield died yesterday at the age of 86. He had leukemia. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
One of Paul Scofield's first roles was Juliet in a schoolboy production of Shakespeare. Much, much later, his King Lear was voted the greatest ever by actors in the Royal Shakespeare Company. Here's a recording from 1965.
Oh, you are men of stones. Had I your tongues and eyes, I'd use them so that heaven's vault should crack.
Schofield was an uncommon actor, not handsome, but commanding. His hangdog brown eyes and sensitive face seemed marked by every role he ever played, among them Salieri, Mozart's tormented nemesis in the original London stage production of Amadeus.
I was suddenly frightened. It seemed to me that I had heard a voice of God, and that it issued from a creature whose voice I had also heard, and it was the voice of an obscene child. I ran home, buried my fear in work, more pupils till there were 30 and 40, more committees, toiling long hours to help musicians, more motets and anthems to God's glory. And at night I prayed for just one thing. Let your voice enter me. Let me be your conduct. Let me.
Starring opposite Schofield as Mozart was character actor Simon Callow. He told the BBC Today that Schofield on stage had an almost intoxicating presence.
He had a kind of extraordinary physical warmth, but almost literally like being near a fire. It was a sort of blaze. And his vocal power was so sensational. His whole chest seemed to vibrate with the extraordinary sounds that he was producing.
That voice reached its widest audience in A Man for All Seasons. In both the stage and movie versions, Schofield played Sir Thomas More. He was Chancellor of England under Henry VIII, and he chose conscience over King.
If we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us saintly. But since we see that avarice, anger, pride, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond charity, modesty, justice, and thought, perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of being heroes.
A Man for All Seasons earned Schofield his only Oscar and gave an early role to actor John Hurt. Hurt still feels a connection between Sir Thomas More and the man who played him.
He was an idealist of a similar kind, and quite ruthless with himself as far as his work was concerned. There was no sellout with Paul.
Hurt says Schofield chose integrity over celebrity. After most performances, he went home directly to his wife of 60 years.
There is a story that goes round that he refused a knighthood on the grounds that he felt that by being called Sir Paul, he felt that the rest of the cast would treat him differently. But the funny thing is that everybody treated him as a knight anyway.
Anonymity was crucial to Paul Schofield's philosophy as an actor. If he had to have a title, Schofield said, Mr. would do just fine. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
About 250 miles northeast of Henderson is the town of Maysville, Kentucky. Next week, Maysville will play host to a very special visitor, George Clooney. The hunky leading man will be in town to screen his new movie, Leatherheads, about the origins of pro football.
I just want to say, stay away from my right knee. Also my right hindquarter, behind my right thigh, but really, the whole hindquarter.
We're joined now by Maysville, Kentucky's Mayor David Cartmell. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So George Clooney, as I understand, grew up in the town of Augusta, Kentucky. That's about 16 miles down the road from you there in Maysville. Why is he screening Leatherheads in your town?
Well, this is kind of, I guess, what you'd call the ancestral home of the Clan Clooney. It's they came to Maysville. And, of course, his father was born here, and they never strayed far from here. Nick, I think, chose Augusta simply because he was working in Cincinnati television, and it was just a little closer.
And Nick is George Clooney's father.
Right, and Rosemary's brother. So we're just pleased that they still are here and still come back.
And I understand this is the second time there's been a big screen event there in Maysville. Back in 1953, Rosemary Clooney's film The Stars Are Singing were shown there. It might have been a bit before your time, but did you hear any stories of what that was like?
My grandmother was mayor then, and we, of course, named Rosemary Clooney Street then, which I guess is the most purloined street sign in our city. We always keep an inventory because, you know, people just love to come through here and have a Rosemary Clooney Street sign. Nick and I for years have been on the same wavelength. You know, I mean, we're an old town and we save everything. And his granddad was mayor here also. And so we have we still have Papa Clooney's fire engine that we pull out for parades that he bought.
Do the beauty parlors get very busy when George Clooney comes to town, all the ladies trying to look their finest?
That is the George Clooney tsunami network in the beauty parlors, yes. And not only that, but it's a hotline. And I think, you know, when there's a George sighting, it immediately goes through the beauty parlors. And I think that's how the newspaper finds out about it.
Mayor, on a more serious note, there's been quite a bit of flooding in your neck of the woods. How's your town holding up?
Yes, we'll be putting in some floodgates today, and they are the same people that put up the bleachers for the premiere and roll out the red carpet. But because we do so many other festivals, they're just used to it. But there'll be a lot of tired people next week because our team is in the state tournament starting today. So yes, there's a lot going on here.
David Cartmell is the mayor of Maysville, Kentucky. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Finally today, news that Oscar-winning filmmaker, the director of The English Patient, and the talented Mr. Ripley, Anthony Minghella, has died at the age of 54. The cause of death, a hemorrhage following neck surgery that he had last week. His most recent project was a BBC television adaptation of the best-selling book, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. That's scheduled to air this Sunday. And in fact, literary adaptations were what he was best known for, including The English Patient.
You promise me you'll come back for me.
I promise. I'll come back for you. I promise. I'll never leave you.
That movie won 9 Academy Awards, including Best Director. And though it was a highbrow, kind of classy period piece, intense emotions, sweeping desert panoramas, the quintessential Oscar movie. There were some critics. On an episode of Seinfeld, Elaine called the movie boring. But in this interview 8 years ago on NPR's Fresh Air, Anthony Minghella showed he could take a joke.
I was enormously flattered that they took the trouble even to... It was an index to me of how much The English Patient had pervaded the public consciousness that anybody would be remotely amused by this. And in fact, in Britain, there was a much more sort of devastating and just devastatingly funny attack on The English Patient. It was called The Toy Patient, in which they dressed up some bears and, you know, woolen rabbits and played out the story with puppets, and it was much funnier and much better than my film.
What is your name?
I don't know. I can't remember anything at all. Wait, I think I'm going to have a multi-award-winning 3-hour flashback.
So, I mean, I just took it as a great compliment, really, that anybody cared enough.
He was born in England to Italian immigrants who owned an ice cream company, Minghella's Ice Cream. He said it was those summers, working for his parents, that drove his artistic aspirations.
I certainly remember the feeling of not being inside the world I wanted to be in, but rather imprisoned in the cage of this ice cream van. I remember vowing then that I would escape from the prison of the ice cream van and try and reinvent myself.
He reinvented himself, first as a music composer, then a playwright, a filmmaker, of course. And 2 years ago, he even directed Puccini's Madame Butterfly at the Metropolitan Opera. Here he is interviewed on Weekend All Things Considered.
We approached this production with as much humility as we ought to have had, in the sense that singers are working all the time, and they're to be standing on the Met stage means that they're at the top of extremely competitive field, they're the best singers in the world. We are first-time opera makers. It's not for us to, you know, revolutionize opera.
Anthony Minghella would be the first person to say he didn't revolutionize filmmaking either. He wasn't the megalomaniac on the set demanding absolute allegiance to his vision, and he was genuinely surprised when people absolutely loved, or sometimes hated, his work.
I feel so uniconoclastic as a filmmaker, and it's always very strange to me that such an equivocal person and such an equivocal filmmaker should excite, you know, such extreme reactions in people.
Anthony Minghella, dead at the age of 54. Thank you. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen.
Movie making depends more and more on the dance of digits. Films are edited digitally. They get their sound digitally. And in just the past few years, movies are using technology that changes color without fancy lighting or painted sets.
That work is revolutionizing the look of films, and it's done by only a handful of major companies. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg visited one of the color maestros.
In a big, dark room in Santa Monica, a 40-something fellow hovers over a digital workstation called Da Vinci. With a palette of keys and dials, Stefan Sonnenfeld is the Da Vinci of movies.
So right now I'm taking this initial image. It's kind of a just right off the truck. And then I'm slowly manipulating the skin tone.
Because she was green before.
And I'm trying to get some nice contrast right now, and I'm getting some color out of the black.
So digital coloring specialist Sonnenfeld is working on the forthcoming film Diary of a Shopaholic. He's loaded the film into his computer, and now he and a Hollywood client, Pat Sandston, project some test shots onto a big screen and fiddle with colors. Changing skin tones is just one of Stefan's talents. He can also change the weather, go from sunny to snowy in a blink. Okay,
so, Pat, this is a
snow test, because this was a 60-degree day in New York.
Right.
So we just want to cool it off and make it feel, you know, wintry in New York, exactly. There you go.
Producer Sandston is experimenting with the look of the test footage in Stefan's studio before the real shooting starts.
This just gives you so many choices. And this is a tool that helps you fix a lot of production issues.
Contrast is good.
I think we'd be warmer in the stores, and then, yeah, that looks good.
The sky changes during the shoot? Not a problem. The color yellow, not quite right? Change it to magenta.
It's basically amped up Photoshop in a high-resolution format. It's easy to do it on a frame or a still, like on your laptop sort of thing.
But when you have hours and hours of images that you need to manipulate for a feature film,
that's the difficult part.
So enter Sonnenfeld and his Da Vinci. This technique has been used in TV ads and on MTV for some time. But in the past few years, full-length movies have gotten into the act. You know how they airbrush those glam images in fashion magazines? Well, digital coloring turns the airbrush into a tornado. It can erase frown lines, eliminate 5 o'clock shadow with a digital shave. Tom Cruise became a fan when he worked with Stefan on Mission Impossible 3.
And I don't think Tom had ever experienced this color correction process before. So when he came in here and realized we could manipulate images and his image too, he was so interested, and we spent time manipulating stuff to make everybody look good or better or
so
worse.
So did you get rid of his double chin or couple of wrinkles under the eye?
Tom is ripped, so he doesn't need the double chin fix. But we did spend time on his close-ups and others, and that's what we do here. That's the whole point of this process.
Listen, I want to help you get whatever you want, but you got to do what's right.
In fact, some stars have digital coloring written into their contracts. And Sonnenfeld says 95% of all films are color corrected now, scene by scene, which makes Stefan Sonnenfeld one of the most influential Hollywood artists we've never heard of.
And we actually don't take credit. This is the first time I think a lonely colorist like me gets a chance to speak to a, you know, an audience about that.
In his lonely studio, Stefan has dabbled with color on Dreamgirls, Pirates of the Caribbean 1, 2, and 3. There were 2,200 visual effects in that one. Also, Into the Wild, National Treasure, and this film, Sweeney Todd.
Benjamin Barker.
No Barker. Sweeney Todd now. And he will have his revenge. Where's my wife?
She's gone.
And here's the actual raw film. Okay, so it's actually brighter and warmer. And what I've done to it is that
you took away its color.
Yeah.
But you know what it looks like, what you've done? It looks as if they're living people, and through your manipulation, you have drained them of their blood, really.
And Tim absolutely wanted that, but not ghastly and not completely devoid of any kind of humanity.
Director Tim Burton got what he wanted. His London is a moving ash heap. except for the blood that his vengeful demon barber Sweeney Todd extracts from his clients. That blood is an ungodly color, so red it assaults the eye. Directors and stars like digital coloring, but a costume designer we know says she hates it. She spends all this time getting the clothing colors just right, and then they come in and tweak everything. Stefan says there were studio executives who used to have similar objections.
There were people who literally said, "We will never do this process. We will never let you do this. We want to have total control, and this gives filmmakers too much flexibility."
But he points out color correction saves setup time on location, saves money and effort.
But it's so dishonest.
Not really. I think everybody appreciates the fact that we try and do the right thing.
I was hoping you'd say no, it's the magic of movies.
It's the magic of movies. There it is.
Are you ready, Norma?
It is the magic of movies.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Gloria Swanson said it in black and white in 1950, but digital coloring specialist Stefan Sonnenfeld could rainbow up her close-ups with the click of a key for today's Sunset Boulevard. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams. A documentary about African-American basketball pioneers and the black colleges that nurtured them debuts tomorrow on ESPN. Black Magic is a two-part film about basketball dreams, some realized through courage, others dashed by racism. NPR's Allison Keyes has this preview.
Jordan, open, Chicago with the lead!
In a world where most players in the National Basketball Association are African American, it's tough to imagine a time when the NBA was all white. In fact, the color line wasn't broken until 1950 by Earl Lloyd. But long before that, African Americans were having a profound effect on basketball. Black Magic director Dan Cloris.
In the 1940s, there was a world championship of basketball held in Chicago, the eight best teams in America. For the entire decade of the 1940s, throughout World War II, it's not an accident that by 1949, the world championship of basketball ended. You know why? The black team started to win.
The film tells how some of the greatest basketball players of their generation, stymied by quotas and racism, still managed to shape the evolution of the game. At a Washington, D.C. screening of the film, Earl the Pearl Monroe was talking about things in it that might surprise people, like...
The secret game in 1944 between Duke and North Carolina College for Negroes. John McGlinden coached that team, and it was played at a time when whites and blacks, it was illegal for them to play against each other.
Coach McGlinden ordered all of the students out of the gym.
From the documentary, then North Carolina college player George Parks set the scene.
So if anything were to happen, they wouldn't get hurt.
John McClendon's widow, Joanna, remembers that the experience was unique for students throughout segregated America.
Some of his players had never had any contact with whites before. Some of them had never touched a white person to shake hands even.
Bowled over by Coach McClendon's pioneering fast break, Duke lost 88-44. Earl Monroe was named as one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history and co-produced the film. He says that game wasn't an isolated incident.
That also made its way to Winston-Salem when I was there because we played against Wake Forest at 12, 1 o'clock at night, you know, because we weren't supposed to be playing against each other. So, you know, there are a lot of revelations in this, as well as the civil rights struggle is interwoven in between all this.
This is bigger than basketball.
Sonny Hill says Black Magic shows younger African-American players how far they've come. He's touched the lives of over 30,000 young people through his 40-year-old Philadelphia-based basketball league.
Basketball is the backdrop to the social problems and the social ills that blacks now, African Americans now, and the Negro and the colored went through.
Director Cloris agrees.
There was a quota system at Harvard, at Yale, at universities, in the workplace. So basketball just mirrored the quota system. And what it did, just as it did in societies, it kept skilled and educated and intelligent men and women from earning their living.
One such man is Cleo Hill, nicknamed Skywalker. In 1961, Hill was the first player from a black institution drafted by the NBA in the first round. But Sonny Hill, no relation, says there was trouble from the start.
Well, Cleo went into a hornet's nest in St. Louis. It was a Southern basketball franchise. They really didn't want black players.
Then, Cleo Hill and several other black players were denied access to a hotel dining room in Lexington, Kentucky. Rather than support Hill, the St. Louis Hawks retaliated and refused to let him play. In the film, it's hard to watch Cleo Hill's face as he tells his story.
After the first game, I scored 26. So when I came, that meant the averages of 27 by Bob Pettit, 23 by Cliff Hagan, 21 by Clyde Drexler. Those averages all broke down because of my scoring ability.
But Cleo Hill was benched, cut from the team, then blackballed from playing in the league ever again. Many of the legendary athletes interviewed for this film are hoping it has a positive effect on young basketball players of color, some of whom seem to have forgotten their roots. 75-year-old coach Ben Jobe has been in basketball since 1940.
In order to have a real future, you got to first embrace your history. And we're paying a dear price because we don't know our history.
Black Magic airs on March 16th and 17th on ESPN. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
And you can watch a trailer and other video from Black Magic on our website, npr.org.